As a fellow at the Yale Law School, I saw that for so many law students, getting a law degree is their ticket to the White House, now either to be a future president, a future U.S. senator, or just to be a staffer working in the White House. And I think the fundamental virtue and cost of the lawyerly society is that the virtue is that there's some degree of pluralism in America. Lawyers are very good at producing debate, making sure that people have their say. But the problem is that lawyers are much better at obstruction than construction. And I would say that the U.S. doesn't have functional infrastructure almost anywhere, especially not in the big cities, which are starving of homes as well as mass transit. And so the U.S. doesn't have stupid ideas like the one-child policy, but it also doesn't have a functional manufacturing base or enough homes for its people.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station of the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to drill down into two very, very critical topics currently facing our nation. One is the ongoing global competition between China and the United States, a topic we've talked about here on this show quite a bit. The other topic is how to get America start building things again. Listeners will recall that I had Mark Dunkelman on my show last summer, who authored a book called Nothing Works. But the author today, my guest today, is somebody uniquely qualified to comment on both of these issues. And so I'm really excited to have him on the show. He's Dan Wong, and he's the author of a book called Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future. He's also currently a research fellow at the Hoover History Lab at Stanford University. Very, very pleased to have you on the show today. Thank you, Dan, for coming on.
Great to speak to you, Robin, from the Midwest, speaking to you from Ann Arbor, Michigan. So it's great to reach other Midwestern folks here.
Cool. Well, I really feel this is an outstanding book, and I recommend it to our listeners because it really provides your perspective on this is what I enjoy the most, because you're not coming at this from our partisan or ideological divide. You come at this, again, as I say, from a unique perspective. If you could talk about your background a little bit, how you came to write the book and your perspective on both countries, that would be a good starting point.
Sure. I am a Canadian. I grew up in the city of Ottawa, and I have spent about equal parts of my life between the U.S., China, as well as in Canada. When I was 16, my folks and I moved from Ottawa to the suburbs of Philadelphia. So my folks are still in Pennsylvania. I attended college in New York State, worked for a little while in Silicon Valley before I moved to China at the start of 2017 to be a technology analyst at a global macro research firm. So I was studying China's tech advancements in semiconductors and clean technologies and science and manufacturing and all sorts of things at a time when President Trump launched his first trade war in 2017, morphed into a technology war. When I saw some worsening repression under Xi Jinping. And I also lived through the entirety of zero COVID policy, which was their pandemic control policy. After that, I moved to the Yale Law School to write this book.
And you've had a chance, as you mentioned, to live in China quite a while. And I really enjoyed reading about your time spent not only in the bigger cities, but in the smaller communities as well, which was interesting. But you lay this out very interestingly to me in the book about the aspects of each society. And in terms of this is taking place in the context of this global competition we're facing. If you would discuss that a little, how each society differs in its approach to its economic growth transformation.
Sure. The first thing I'll say is that I think that Chinese and Americans are the two most alike peoples in the world. They are awfully pragmatic. They like to take shortcuts. They are often crassly materialistic. They are engines of global change. And I think these two countries view themselves as enormous, big countries, that everyone else is a smaller country, and therefore they have to get in line. And I think that's no surprise that it is Shenzhen and Silicon Valley and Beijing and Wall Street that are driving a lot of the big changes throughout the world. But there is a big difference with how these two countries are governed. And so after living in China for about 6 years, I thought that, thinking through these two countries as capitalist or socialist or neoliberal, whatever that means, it's not a very useful guide for, these 19th century political science terms should not be used to reason through the great competition of the 21st century. And so, to be just inventive and playful, I introduced two new terms to understand the US and China. So China's a country I call the engineering state, because at various points, the entirety of the senior leadership have had degrees in engineering. So these were people trained in hydraulic engineering and electrical engineering and mechanical engineering. They treat the physical environment as a big engineering project, which is part of why China has built so many roads and bridges and high-speed rail and solar, wind, nuclear, and homes throughout the country. They also treat the economy as an engineering project, which they try to turn China's smartest university grads into working on, let's say, strategic technologies like semiconductors, rather than in China's equivalent of Wall Street or Silicon Valley. And they're also engineers of the soul. I spend a lot of time working on writing about social engineering projects like the one-child policy, as well as zero COVID, in which the numbers right there in the name, they really treat society as yet another building material to be torn down and remolded and optimized as they wish. I contrast that with the United States, which I call the lawyerly society. As a fellow at the Yale Law School, I saw that for so many law students, getting a law degree is their ticket to the White House, now either to be a future president, a future U.S. senator, or just to be a staffer working in the White House. And I think the fundamental virtue and cost of the lawyerly society is that the virtue is that there's some degree of pluralism in America. Lawyers are very good at producing debate, making sure that people have their say. But the problem is that lawyers are much better at obstruction than construction. And I would say that the U.S. doesn't have functional infrastructure almost anywhere, especially not in the big cities, which are starving of homes as well as mass transit. And so the U.S. doesn't have stupid ideas like the one-child policy, but it also doesn't have a functional manufacturing base or enough homes for its people.
And we can, right now, I think listeners know you pick up the newspaper. Well, if you pick up a newspaper, you probably read it on your phone or tablet. But the threatening clouds forming over the relationship between the U.S. and China militarily, we don't need to get into that. But you're talking about areas here, I think, where we got something alike, and hopefully we can work together to avert any kind of military type confrontation. So it gives me hope reading this book.
I want to be hopeful. And I am, now that I'm a fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, I want to self-identify as a sunny Californian, always with greater hope for the future.
Well, and us Midwesterners share that. We try to be optimistic as well, I think. But I really thought that the example you gave of rail, that highlighted the differences between the engineering society and the lawyerly society, was really good. If you would talk about that, because I've read about the American example you gave, and it just seems like it's taking forever.
Yeah, it is absolutely taking forever, especially the California high-speed rail project. So we can get into a little bit of detail about what that involved. 2008 was a very important year for high-speed rail for both the United States as well as China. So in 2008, voters in California approved a referendum to build a California high-speed rail project between its two largest cities, San Francisco in the north and Los Angeles in the south. And in 2008, China actually started construction of its high-speed rail line between its two largest cities, Beijing in the north and Shanghai in the east. Coincidentally, actually, both these high-speed rail systems are around the same length, but that is where the difference ends. What has happened to high-speed rail in China? Well, 3 years later, China actually completed the high-speed rail project. State media has claimed that it came at a cost of around $40 billion, and over the first decade of its operation, it completed about 1.4 billion passenger trips between Beijing and Shanghai, the political capital in the north, as well as the biggest city, much more of the commercial center in the eastern part of the country. What has happened to California high-speed rail? Has any of us ridden California high-speed rail? Well, the answer is no, because we are now about 17 years after the initial referendum. Essentially, a few miles of concrete has been poured in the desert in California, but they keep trying to reduce the scale and the ambition of California high-speed rail. No, essentially, not much track has actually been laid. The initial segment, which is supposed to connect the cities of Bakersfield and Merced, not very close to major metropolises like SF and LA, that is supposed to begin operating between 2030 and 2033. And I would be very surprised if 3 decades after voters approved this referendum to connect these two big cities by rail, any of us would be able to actually take a train from San Francisco to LA. I think that what we should do is either completely cancel this project and stop sending bad money after bad money, or we should actually get it done. And if the voters in California, which is I think the fifth largest economic entity in the world, much richer than most European countries, if if this region, if America's largest state says it wants to build high-speed rail, it needs to get it done, and this high-speed rail train really ought to gleam. But right now we are in this awful situation in which the state says it wants to do it, and it simply cannot get it done.
Of an example that may be more closer to home here is with broadband. There was money put in the infrastructure law, I believe, to bring broadband to more rural areas. And I don't know, your book addresses that. Has that been done to any degree since that law was passed?
You're exactly right, Robin, that at the end of 2021, President Joe Biden and the US Congress passed the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, which is meant to connect rural broadband, which is meant to connect a lot of rural areas of the country to broadband. And as I finished my book shortly after President Trump took office, I wrote that. No, about 4 years after passage of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, not a single home has actually been connected to rural broadband. This is an initiative called Internet for All. This was a initiative under the direction of the then Vice President Kamala Harris. Essentially, they spent a lot of time trying to map out these regions, really to try to figure out where to place broadband. There were a lot of requirements to have, let's say, if I'm getting this right, minority owners of construction businesses who also have to be unionized. And there was also preference for female-owned construction businesses, which are not prevalent across the country. And so by the time that you finish checking off all of these boxes, President Joe Biden lost control of the White House. We have a new president who's much less interested, frankly, in building solar or wind or much infrastructure throughout the country.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very delighted to have as my guest today Dan Wong, who's the author of a really interesting book called Breakback: China's Quest to Engineer the Future. He's also a research fellow at the Hoover History Lab at Stanford University. We've been talking a little bit about his book, and I recommend this book if you're interested in learning more about the economic competition between China and the United States. I smiled when I saw you reference Robert Moses in this book because I finally made it through his entire book last year. I celebrated. It's a
Yes.
lengthy book, but you're saying basically we should go back to the Moses approach to building things.
I think that we don't need to go back fully to the Robert Moses approach, but I think that we have some things to learn from America's past as its own engineering state. I want to say that the U.S. used to be able to build fantastic projects. So from the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century, the United States built enormous canal systems across the country, built rail systems, built highway systems. It built the first skyscrapers in Chicago, as well as in Manhattan, built the Golden Gate Bridge, the Hoover Dam, the Manhattan Project, as well as the Apollo missions. These are instances of the technological sublime, which have inspired the rest of the world. And I think a lot about this character, Robert Moses, who is immortalized in Robert Caro's monumental biography, The Power Broker, which all of us had to read last year because it was the 50th anniversary of the publication of the book. After reading it, Robin, I got a mug that said, I finished The Power Broker. So maybe you should get exactly the same mug. I think, yes, I think a lot Thank about Robert Moses because, you know, he was someone who is recognizably Chinese, who built at breakneck speed. He was someone who built all of these fantastic projects in New York City, which are completely iconic. Things like the Lincoln Center, things like the United Nations building, things like Flushing's Meadow Park, and all sorts of bridges, public housing works that Robert Moses built. And I think there is a flaw in Robert Caro's depiction of the power broker. And it starts with a subtitle. The subtitle of the book is Robert Moses and the Fall of New York City. Now, I take a look at New York City, and it hardly seems like a fallen city to me. It has kept gaining population, unlike most Midwestern towns. So if we take a look at the population of New York City between 1950 to today, that has grown somewhat from that time. And if we take a look at a lot of American fading industrial towns in the upper Midwest, cities like Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Detroit, where nearby where I'm speaking to you from in Ann Arbor. You know, these Midwestern cities have fallen in terms of population by about two-thirds from 1950. And New York City is still one of the most functional cities in America. It has reliable mass transit, which is a claim that very few other places can make. It is a city that continues to attract a lot of America's best and brightest in the way that San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago can also claim. And there are all of these cultural institutions that Robert Moses has built that have made in part, have imparted their gleam to the rest of New York City. So if we take a look at something like the Lincoln Center, which houses the opera, the ballet, as well as the New York Philharmonic, you know, this is a classic elitist institution. What could be more elitist than the ballet, right? But this is also an institution that has attracted a lot of global visitors to New York City that Robert Moses organized is a really, really good. And so I'm not saying that we need to go back to the era of Robert Moses. I just take a look at that era of a city planner that was able to commit to building infrastructure, doing it below budget without hints of corruption. And I think this is a little bit more of the spirit that we need to recover in America today.
I was heartened to see you talk about manufacturing because our region of the country, as people know, we lost a lot of our manufacturing base nationwide. We did, but it particularly hit the Midwest hard and many towns right around here where I am airing this show. Companies picking up going overseas over the past 30, 40 years. You talk about the importance of manufacturing in a way that I think most people miss. If you could talk about that a little bit, what you wrote in the book there.
Sure. I think that although the Midwest has absolutely lost a lot of jobs, a lot of the automotive industry has moved to the South, to the Southeast. And so that was kind of nationwide movement. And then a lot of other sorts of non-automotive manufacturing has moved overseas to East Asia, especially to China. And I think that there's something that the Chinese really appreciate about manufacturing that I think is not adequately appreciated in the United States, which is that technology has to be practiced for it to be maintained and for it to be grown. That technology ultimately exists in the heads of people as well as in the hands of a lot of the workers. And so I spent a lot of time in China visiting these vast industrial manufacturing complexes in cities like Shenzhen, which famously has made a lot of the early iPhones and still continues to make most of the advanced iPhones that people continue to buy. That China, has been closed to a lot of American manufacturing, but has also been very open to a lot of big manufacturers in particular, like Walmart, like Apple, like Tesla, which have moved very substantial parts of their manufacturing to China. And so what these companies have done, Walmart, Tesla, Apple, is that they're really training Chinese workers to be some of the most sophisticated manufacturers in the world. So you have all of these workers who are solving three new problems a day before breakfast. And they are the cutting edge of maintaining manufacturing knowledge alive, which makes it much easier for them to invent new products as well. And so when they have all of this practice, solving new problems becomes really easy for workers in Shenzhen to put together iPhones 1 year, then make a Huawei phone the next year, then make a drone the following year, and then make an electrical vehicle battery. Whereas in the industrial Midwest, once you have a factory closure, a lot of people are thrown out of work. They can't necessarily maintain all of this knowledge. You have these cascading skill losses, and a lot of these communities really are unable to, maintain technological production or indeed their own livelihoods. And so I think that has been a problem in America, that the Chinese have a much better way of appreciating that knowledge really has to be maintained for it to thrive.
Let's get to what I guess what should our proper approach to China be? Going back to the first Trump administration, he's used tariffs, as everybody knows, as a policy tool. And he wants to sincerely try to build back up the U.S. manufacturing base. I don't think anybody expects it to be like it was in the 1950s. But there is value in building stuff here. And I think it's important, as you lay out in the book, why. So Biden continued some of this approach and restrictions on technological exports, certain technological exports. But what's your advice if you were advising the administration on the proper approach to China?
Yeah, well, I think it first starts with understanding. And I wrote this book in part out of recognition that many Americans might visit parts of East Asia. Let's say they would want to visit Tokyo and Kyoto. Maybe they want to visit South Korea. Some people even want to visit Taiwan, but many people will simply never make it to China. And I wanted to write this book in part to give Americans a sense of the dense, textured life of what China is. And I think everyone in the Midwest knows that things going on in San Francisco are very different from what's going on in Illinois or Iowa, where you're speaking from, Robin, which is very different from New York City, which is very different from Dallas, Texas, and on we can go. And I also want to say that life in Beijing is really different from life in Shanghai, which is really different from life in Chongqing, and on we can go. And so just giving people a sense of the texture is really important. And then after we have the curiosity, we can have a debate about what policy really ought to mean. And I think that maybe tariffs have a right place in America's policy toolbox against China. One problem is that President Trump is pretty indiscriminate with the tariffs. He's tariffing absolutely everyone. He's tariffing traditional American allies like Europe or Japan or Canada, all of whom are complaining about suffering ruinous amounts of tariffs. And, I think there are certain ways in which I think that tariffs are not a 21st century tool, but almost a 16th century tool for how to control the economy. And I think that we have a much better model for industrialization in the 21st century. And that is China. China, which has welcomed a lot of foreign investment, namely from Walmart, Tesla, Apple, as well as from hundreds of big American companies, as well as European, Japanese, all sorts of companies to invest in the country. They recognize they were behind in all sorts of ways. They were very intent on building much better infrastructure to support their manufacturing businesses. And they had all sorts of supportive policies like building out more clean energy for their businesses to use as well. And so rather than studying from a 16th century playbook, I think Americans should be a little bit more curious about, what is the 21st century playbook, maybe inviting more Asian companies to invest in America and building much better infrastructure as well.
Seems like you're saying that we have a lack of respect towards China in a way, and the best thing we could do is drop that veneer and learn from them and do kind of what they're doing in some ways.
I want to say that we all should have greater curiosity about the rest of the world. I don't know if respect is quite the right framing, but let's just think about, how are the French and the Spanish and the Danish and the Japanese building much better public works than the Americans? There are all sorts of ways in which the Europeans are even more automated in terms of their ports or in terms of their subway trains than the Americans are. I think that there's all sorts of ways that the Americans can be more curious about what is going on in Asia. And so I am advocating for curiosity for the rest of the world and then thinking about what lessons could be applied here at home.
I got a final question for you, Dan. I got about 2 minutes here. What I like about your book, and I have to say this a lot, it seems like in this hyper-partisan era we're living through, is your book takes an even-handed approach here. It's not left or right. And in fact, you're critical of both sides, the left and the right, in their approaches. I think this would be a good way to end up here. What are your criticisms as far as in a context of what we need to do moving forward as a country?
Robin, can we have another hour to discuss what's wrong with the American left and the American right? Very simply, let's say on the topic, let's just keep it very narrow on the topic of manufacturing. I think that President Biden had the right approach to say, let's invest a lot at home, which is to build a lot more infrastructure, like building more rural broadband throughout rural areas. And then the lawyers took over, and there was essentially very little pace. There was essentially very little urgency to actually build these sort of big, important projects. By the time that nothing got built, President Trump was reelected. And President Trump does not seem to have a lot of interest in building public infrastructure. He seems to really hate wind turbines. There's a lot of great wind in the Midwest, and he is just not very interested in scaling up wind production, which is a source of clean energy. And I think that tariffs are mostly the wrong approach. They're creating too much uncertainty among manufacturers. And so, I think what we need is good investment as well as a lot of effort to actually build these critical infrastructure projects.
Well, we barely touched the surface, trust me, on this important book, and we're out of time. There's a lot more here, and I have to just say before I close, I admire China in a lot of ways. They come up with these 5-year plans. There's a Made in China 2025 that is in Dan's book, where China wants to dominate tech industries. We need something similar, and we get into these old stale debates about the role of government. We just need to come together as a country. And again, go get this book and read it. It's a very even-handed, smart book on a couple very, very important topics for our country's future. My guest today, Dan Wong, who's the author of this book called Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future. Dan, thank you so much, and I'd love to have you back at some point. We could talk more politics.
Robin, that would be a delight. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK Quad Cities NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.